Yeah, thank you. Welcome back, everybody. Can I just check that Sherm is still on the line in New York?
On the line.
Cheers, Sherm. Thank you. The reason being that this next session is trying to look at user needs. And Mary earlier spoke about the conceptual framework. One thing that she didn't explicitly talk about was the conceptual framework also includes the objective of financial reporting. And that's clearly very important for this project as well, in that we want to make sure that the information that goes into the financial statements is going to be useful to the primary users. And we appreciate there are lots of different types of users of financial statements. Regulators, I know, are important users. But the focus of the conceptual framework is mainly on potential and existing lenders and
yep.
investors who may have a slightly different need. So this session, we really want to try and explore what information is important to users. Also, what information do preparers of financial statements give to the users, whether it's in financial statements or not in financial statements, so that we can get more of a feel of what information is essential before we then move on to think about whether that can be incorporated in financial statements or it's better presented elsewhere. I have asked the users and the regulators of the group to perhaps start off this session before opening up to the preparers and the others around the room. I'm conscious that Tim is not sitting in his seat at the moment.
Where's the cam?
I'll perhaps kick this off and ask Sherm, who's at Standard & Poor's, perhaps Sherm, if you're willing to kick off and explain as an analyst what information it is that you're looking for when looking at rate-regulated entities.
I'd be glad to. I hope you can hear me. What we're trying to determine in coming up with a rating is the ability and willingness of a debt issuer to pay back their debt. The willingness we will determine partially by looking at the financial statements, have they paid their debt in the past, but also talking with management and understanding their philosophy and the way they structure the business. The ability to pay back the debt comes almost directly from the financial statements, their ability to pay, to generate cash that can be used to pay debt. In evaluating a company for determining a rating, we'll look at a bunch of factors. We'll start with country risk and industry risk. Clearly, a rate-regulated utility where there is strong regulation has less risk than perhaps other industries. And we have found that we look at the strength of the regulation in the United States. We may have more than 50 regulators, one in each state, for electric utilities, for example. And we'll look at the strength of the regulation in each state. We evaluate each regulator on their credit supportiveness. And we'll also look at the strength of the regulation as it relates to a particular issuer. They may be able to manage their relationship with the regulator. One may be able to manage that relationship better than another, and we'll take that into account also. One of the factors that we look at that involves the financial statements is in determining the business risk is their competitive position. One of the key things that you look at in determining competitiveness is the profitability and the volatility of earnings. In the past, I have done some studies that would show us what kind of volatility we might see from rate-regulated electric utilities if they did not have regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities. If those amounts went to income directly, and the volatility would be huge. Said another way, that stability of earnings is a significant factor in why utilities are rated very highly as a general rule. The second thing that we'll look at, another area that we'll look at, is the financial risk. And that comes directly from ratios that we'll look at that involve cash flow and leverage. For example, we'll look at what we call funds from operations to debt, or debt to EBITDA, and then there are other ratios that we'll look at that help us determine that. Those probably are more from the cash flow statement. Then we'll have items or areas that may modify our basic conclusions. Those include diversity. For a regulated entity, that might be different geographic areas with different regulators. Capital structure definitely comes off the balance sheet. What's their, how much do they fund through debt? How much do they fund through equity? Liquidity. How liquid? How much liquidity does the entity have? We'll also look at a few other things that might not financial statement, like management and governance. The final thing that we do before determining the final rating is compare an entity to other entities. So comparability of financial reporting and consistency, both within and from between entities and between years, is important for us. I think I'll end it right there. If there are any questions?
Okay. Thanks, Sean. One question I do have is, you mentioned that when you're looking at the strength of regulation, one thing that you look at in particular is the relationship between the entity and the entity's regulator. And I just wondered where that sort of information comes from.
It generally comes from the ability of the entity to... that would come from discussions with management and reviews of rate cases, and the ability of the entity to collect, recover costs in a reasonable time period, on a reasonable basis.
Right. So you would track a lot of these rate cases are publicly available on the regulator side. So part of your analysis would be going through the various negotiations that are publicly available.
Yes.
Thank you.
Let me ask just a quick question. On that very last point, you mentioned comparability. Can you share some observations when you compare rate entities who use rate reg accounting and IFRS entities who have not? Are you modifying either of those financials to perform your comparability analysis?
That's very difficult because it's hard to modify a non regulated entity to make them comparable to a regulated entity. What we would see would be greater volatility in income.
I've got a question on the study you did to look at volatility if entities were not allowed to defer. And very interesting that you said they were very volatile, which is not surprising. Did you do any assessment of the causes of that volatility? Because I'm quite interested to know whether there should be some elements of deferral accounts that actually reflect the sort of volatility that you want to reflect in financial statements rather than, say, a genuine under-recovery of costs, for example. So the summary of the question was, did you analyze further the reasons for volatility?
Yes and no. The you know, some of the major regulatory accounts relate to pension cost recovery, asset retirement obligations, definitely fuel recovery. So it's really a timing issue. When will they get the costs back?
Mary, a question for Sherman. In looking at financial statements of regulated entities and thinking of the range of types of regulation that we just discussed in terms of descriptions that came in response to the request for information, question for Sherman is, do you feel that you're able from the financial statements to understand the degree of certainty and specificity, you know, provided by the regulatory regime in terms of recoverability of regulatory related assets and liabilities? I mean, can you, do you care about, and if so, can you see the difference between a variance account that presumably lead to recovery of those specific amounts versus, let's say, a rate of return target, you know, or cap that may lead to adjustments in future of the return, but not as explicitly to recovery of specific costs or positive or negative variances?
See if I can answer that. The and when we look at the recoverability of, say, a regulatory asset, it certainly would be nice if one knew for sure that a regulatory asset would be recovered. There is judgment that's involved in that. Sometimes regulatory assets are written off. If that could be strengthened, that would be great. I'm not sure how you could do that. But, you know, rate of return, I think, is separate from the recoverability of regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities, the payment of those.
Because I was thinking, I was thinking of some of the facts that Jesus described, talking about toll roads as an example, and whether you cared about the difference in the structure of the regulation from some of the more cost-based ones that have been described. If you cared about that difference, and if you thought it would be helpful or not to see any impacts of those different regulatory regimes on the financial statements presented in similar ways or different ways to understand, you know, that they were all regulatory related or differently to understand the different types. Or does it not matter, or do you maybe not look at that many that are maybe more rate of return structures?
I think that in our what we call utility practice, we're looking at the three basic utilities, water, gas, electricity. And toll roads, I haven't seen one presented as a regulated entity and reviewed as a regulated entity. They may show up in our project financing area where they're public-private partnerships, but that is separate. And never seen a regulatory asset or regulatory liability there. So, you know, do they have a, you know, is there a place for those in evaluating their ability to pay debt? And do we do that? Yes, but not in the same way that we look at utilities that have a regulatory structure.
Thanks. Helpful.
Dwayne.
Sherman, this is Dwayne Despard. I'm the controller at Exelon. You had mentioned, you know, it would be nice to have certainty about any asset on the balance sheet, but you mentioned regulatory asset. And I think one of the things, just curious your reaction, if the accounting model, and of course we're in the States, but so if the accounting model in the States were such that we did not book regulatory assets and liabilities, we had the volatility just flow through, you know, then I'm assuming that that will give you even less clarity, less transparency as to what's likely, what's not likely to be achieved, and that do you take any kind of comfort knowing that management has made an assertion through its financial reporting that we believe this is a good asset or we believe we owe a liability, versus if we didn't do that at all and we just kind of let the numbers flow, you know, how would you handle that in terms of dealing with a particular utility in terms of trying to evaluate with management what's really going on? And I guess I'm just trying to see how much are you relying on the financials, and if they weren't there, what would you have to do in the alternative?
Okay, let me, you know, the easy part to answer here is that in looking at the ability to pay debt, cash flow is the critical thing. And regulatory, the creation of regulatory assets and liabilities does not affect cash flow. So some of our analysts would say we're agnostic to the use of regulatory liabilities. And the next breath they'll say, but if you take it away, at least disclose it in the footnotes so we can make adjustments. that's the point I'm trying to make. Let us make the adjustments to profitability so we can see the consistent profitability that a utility should have. That helps us to evaluate their business profile.
And I would imagine that to figure out cash flow, you're looking at receivables and payables as the first indicator of what's to come. I mean, the cash flow statement is a historical statement.
We're looking at the historical statements, and we're also using that to predict the future. We'll look at several measures. We'll look at something we call funds from operations, which is a somewhere between income and cash flow from operations. We'll exclude operating accounts in there in calculation. We'll also look at EBITDA. We'll also look at cash flow from operations. And we'll look at free operating cash flow, discretionary cash flow, just down the cash flow.
And the EBITDA, if earnings were very volatile, that metric presumably would be less helpful.
That metric would be less helpful, and as would, it would be less helpful. That's why the analysts would say, but if you don't, you are allow the use of regulatory assets and liabilities, then at least tell us what they would be. You asked about recoverability, and you know, it certainly gives us comfort that the company has concluded that the regulatory assets and liabilities are reasonable and likely to be recovered or paid. Also gives us comfort that the auditor has looked at that. Does that mean they'll never be written off? No, they won't. And it would be nice to know that they wouldn't be, but that's something we'll never accomplish, never get to that level of comfort. I recognize that.
Thanks, Sherman.
Any other questions for Sherman?
Okay, thanks. Tim. Perhaps if we can hear from you, if there's anything you'd like to add in terms of, we've heard a little bit from you about your perspective as a lender, but is there anything else about the information that's available in the financial statements that you would look particularly for, or do you get information about the regulation elsewhere?
I think the statements themselves are a great source of information. The overwhelming majority of ones we see in our portfolio in Canada have regulatory accounting, if you will, so we can see it in the actual statements where things are, and we can understand that. We have one name in the portfolio, Richard's company, that is IFRS, an IFRS filer or an IFRS compliant entity, however you phrase it. I think you rely more on note disclosure then, and I'm not an accountant, so I'll defer to everybody here. I'm in a room full of accountants, but I'm not sure whether note disclosure is in the eye of the beholder, or there's a minimum standard and some people meet the minimum and other people don't go beyond the minimum. I think in AltaLink's example, they go well beyond they need to, I think, just to be prudent. So, I mean, we could probably look at their statements and get it from the notes, but so that's kind of a broad comment. I think from a practical level, once something's in the portfolio and you're deciding whether they're compliant or not, you're doing stuff like measuring covenants. When you've got a whole portfolio that measures covenants a certain way based on accounting standards that have been around for a while, and you have one guy who is IFRS, in that particular case, as the agent bank on a facility, we had to kind of come at the thing and say, okay, how to a person who spent 15, 20, 25 years looking at interest cover this way, or looking at debt to cash flow or debt to cap this way, how can we make this as easy on people as we can? And in the AltaLink example, it was determined with management and their auditors that we could, it wasn't too much trouble for them to calculate covenants or continue to calculate covenants in Canadian GAAP as it existed prior to the adoption of IFRS. So we have a covenant regime in place where, again, for the people looking at them, they can make comparisons across the entire portfolio. This guy's at this level, this guy's at this level, that makes sense, rather than have to figure out what another level means, because different levels have different meanings for people who have been doing it for a while, and you get a different result on the covenants. So there's the disclosure piece around how do you track it all, and then there's the ongoing portfolio stuff, which is how do you compare names across a portfolio if you've got a whole bunch of people doing things differently, or the overwhelming number of people in the portfolio doing it this way and you've got other people doing it another way. In this example, we were able to find a happy medium where we could kind of get comparability across the portfolio, but I guess we're lucky in that regard. Then another comment to make, and I think it's at the right point of the discussion, but we had a bit of a kind of a users meeting in Toronto about a month or so ago. The largest, basically the only, there are a few small exceptions, but the largest transmission company in Ontario, they've got five different ways that they prepare financials. The regulator wants it a certain way. The securities regulator, whoever they are regulated by, wants it another way. The auditors want it another way. There were two others that were beyond my non-accounting brain to but at the meeting, you know, this person was preparing five different statements or using five different methodologies. So not necessarily from my perspective as a user of these statements, but as somebody who's a preparer, that's asking a lot. It's expensive, it's time consuming, et cetera, et cetera. So those are kind of some thoughts.
If there are no other specific questions, perhaps.
Jennifer. Sorry. If I could, sorry, it's Dwayne. Did we, in the responses, and I don't remember, did we hear from equity side analysts at all much?
No, the request for information was really asking for factual information about the regulations. So in lots of ways that restricted the audience, I guess, for the users. We did have two responses that listed in the appendix from users, but one was a consumer group, consumer advocates group, and the other specific user was an association of valuers and consultants, so no analysts, but that was not really unexpected because of the nature of the request.
I guess in a similar vein that I would just offer, we've talked with some of our analysts in the States and to get their perspectives, and I guess one of the things that's stuck with me is the ability to go to your income statement and be able to get the best view you can as to the return that you can compare to equity and kind of get, okay, is the regulator giving them the return on equity that, you know, everybody said the regulator is supposed to help you get a fair return. And by virtue of getting kind of trued up, the income statement side trued up, regardless of the timing of the cash flows, but getting it trued up, that gives a much clearer picture and a more comparative picture year over year over year as to the trends about, okay, are they in fact earning the return that the regulator is purporting to allow? And it might be that management's not dealing with the regulator well. Somebody mentioned kind of the relationship with the regulator, and are the two able to work together? It could be the regulator is very punitive. It could be a lot of things, but at least you have that visibility of the trend one way or the other, that if we didn't have reg assets and liabilities in my company, I think we'd have tremendous volatility for fuel costs and storm costs, and there'd have to be all these adjustments made in order to get any kind of useful information for that purpose, at least. So, for the record, that's what we've been told by the analysts that we've talked with.
Thank you.
And this is Sherm again, that I agree with you completely. Without regulatory accounting, a measure of profitability is would have to be adjusted significantly, would have to have significant amounts of information to do that, and may not be even possible.
Does that actually answer my question?
Richard.
So maybe I could add something to this. There is another utility in Alberta which has adopted IFRS but has not recognized any of their regulatory assets and liabilities. And so what has happened there is if we look at the financial statements at the front of their report, we get the numbers in accordance with IFRS, which don't have these things in there. Then they have a separate note, and what they have done is they've used the segment note to provide what they think are the real numbers. And they obviously they're not allowed to say that, but they have put wording into their, particularly in their MD&A, Management Discussion and Analysis, which says these are the numbers that you have to look at if you want to figure out how we're truly doing as a business. So we have to be careful with this notion that we can somehow overcome the fact that we don't include the numbers up front in the statements, and instead we're going to use disclosure to make sure that people get all of the information that they need. It's not the answer.
Michelle?
Yeah, that's the comment I wanted to make. You're talking about the utility in Alberta. We have 9 utilities in Canada that have converted to IFRS. None of them recognize regulatory assets per se, other than financial instruments in your case, Richard. And not only in Alberta, but there's also 5 utilities in Ontario that do the same thing in their segmental information. They reproduce their regulatory assets and their regulatory accounts. So they will provide a balance sheet, a profit and loss account, and they say, forget, you know, ignore the first pages, this is the real one, you know, and they will reconcile that back, you know, to the front. But it's just to say that, can we just provide information in the notes if we don't recognize them, but at the end of it, what we providing in the notes, it's in a set of financial statements. Does it really make sense if the notes is overtaking, you know, what we should call the financial statement or so-called financial statements?
PK.
I think this is extremely helpful, this discussion. I want to ask a question, though. In those regimes and those countries where regulatory asset is not recognized under existing IFRS, how are companies, preparers, coping with that? Is that the same thing, footnotes or segment information is taking care of that plugging? Or how are the users dealing, coping up with that aspect? Because I understand in Canada, it's you're changing from one to the other, so or in the United States, it's one thing. But for people who are not used to this for many, many years now, how are users coping up and how are preparers preparing them? Pascal is ready.
Yeah, I'm ready. I'm ready to ask. No, regarding my company, it's not so mature, so at the group level, we do not provide information, and even no notes or IFRS 8 information or different disclosure, but at the level of the BU, or the business, they just told me that for them it's a nightmare because they have to be concise because they have to present internal budget forecast with accounting, with regulatory assets and liabilities, and they have even they have to commit to one budget and so on with taking into this account these assets and liabilities, because as we've said before, it's just impossible to understand the performance of the company if you do not take into account these assets and liabilities. So for them and for internal purpose, it's a limited business. And but as far for the group is concerned, it's not mature, so the information is not. But for another French utility involved in the power transmission, the information is given in the MD&A. And that's a discussion we have, and so we have to provide this information by auditors for separate accounts in IFRS, and the answer I made is that if it's valuable information, it's in the balance sheet. I don't understand if it's not assets and liabilities, what kind of information we should provide as a disclosure. Because as we feel that the risk is very limited, so we will recover this asset. So we feel that the criteria of recognition are met. How are we going to disclose for such assets and liabilities in the notes? Does it make sense?
Leonardo.
Okay. In our case, regulatory accounts are very relevant when we think about our figures. For instance, our net income in the last year would be four times higher if I had the possibility to include it our regulatory accounts in our financial statements. That's very huge. So if you don't provide additional information for our investors, for the banks, for the rate agencies, it's impossible to understand our business. So we have to inform every quarter how much we paid and was not included in our tariff, or how was the expense that were included in our rate setting adjustment. So we have a lot of information that you have to provide to our investors to make our investors understand our business. In the item 5 here, there is a comment that some investors understand regulatory issues. They are more concerned about those questions. It's true. I can say that if an investor, a user, doesn't understand how the regulatory framework works, I believe he is not able to make the right decision about an investment in a company, or to understand well the performance of a utility.
Hey, perhaps it's a good point for me to step in, given I was an equity analyst for 16 years, so I can address
Duane's points, and then I can also provide some regulatory perspectives from a regulator and then a securities regulator. Should I go forward, or?
Yeah. Can I just follow up one question to Leonardo? Well, since you've just recently adopted IFRS and yes. then dropped the asset and liability recognition regarding to, did you identify market reaction in terms of the pricing of the company soon after the IFRS adoption?
I don't think that there was a effect in our share market share due to the IFRS adoption, but the investors they are not happy. Okay, I can say that. They of course the adoption of IFRS was very good for our country, for our jurisdictions. There are a lot of benefits, but when we think about our industry, it's impossible to compare our financial statements. Okay, we can't compare. For instance, another company in Brazil presented a net income in 2012, but when we include the regulatory assets, it would be a loss. So you have to provide a fair amount of additional information, and there is a distance between the investors who understand well the business and are able to make decisions properly. And those ones who that doesn't understand well the business, and there are in the risk for these guys, the risk to make wrong decisions is higher now.
Karen, before we come back to you, Jesus has been waiting.
Yes, okay. Two questions. I think an important question related to users is that normally the regulators as also users of financial information, and normally they are asking for a special set of accounts that are called regulated accounts that recognize this type of assets. So it's I think a question that has to be taken in mind here in the discussion, that normally regulators asking for financial statements including the regulated assets in the balance sheet of the companies. And related with the discussion we had in Spain when we had to apply in 2005 the first application of the IFRS, we had according with the rules we had regulatory assets in different toll roads businesses, and unfortunately we had to write down that asset applying the rules, and that's a question that has to be discussed now today, but in 2005 it was clear that it was impossible to recognize regulatory assets according with IFRS, and this was, as you said, a total change in the profit and loss of the companies. As Amaro asked, finally, this didn't have an impact in the share price of the company because the analysts analyzed the information that which is the real information. But the conclusion was that the financial statements was not useful to understand what was happening in the company. So the final situation is that the financial statements were not making the objectives that are established for this financial statement. So they use another type of financial information, as our Canadian colleague says, segmenting or other type of information that is disclosed by the company to explain what's happening in the company. But people say financial statements are not useful.
So, Karen, I think we'll come back to you now.
I'm sorry?
We'll come back to you now. You interjected before.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Go on.
So I'm going to give a very brief three perspectives. First is the sell-side equity analyst. In general, I concur with what both Standard & Poor's and Jim from Royal Bank have said, but the equity analyst position is a little bit more involved than the debt level. And we need to calculate, obviously, the earnings per share for a company, the growth rate in earnings per share. We need to understand when the company will need to issue additional capital, both debt and equity. that all flows into the valuation, and we take a fairly holistic approach. So we do pay attention to what happens at the debt level, and we certainly need to forecast and estimate the timing and size of equity issues. So we are typically of the view there needs to be a direct nexus between the financial statements and the drivers of a company's performance. Determining those levels prior to IFRS was difficult and has become much more difficult now. As a result of the difficulty with the financial statements over a period of time, most analysts spend a considerable length of time in the rate-regulated filings, regardless of who it is. We tend to use the rate filing information as the basis for the earnings calculation and tend then to reconcile or to attempt to reconcile it back to the published financial statements for the purposes of issuing capital. The equity side does not have access to material non-public information, which Standard & Poor's would have access to, as would the private lenders being the banks. We don't have access to management, or did not typically have access to management, to provide detailed reconciliations that they were prepared to make public. So you would then have to bridge the gap yourself. So therefore, we had to understand the nature of regulation that, generally speaking, was not reflected in the financial statements. The cost of capital can change as a result of poor disclosure in financial statements, in terms of published financial statements, because the gap, the principal agent problem that we try to rectify, this minimization of the separation between the shareholders and the management of the company, cannot be achieved. And the greater the misunderstanding about the risk profile of the company, the higher the cost of capital. And S&P would certainly attest to that, because if it affects your rating, your cost of debt goes up, and if the equity analyst doesn't understand the earnings drivers, your cost of capital goes up, and that includes the volatility component. From a regulatory perspective, the regulator is not going to cease using regulatory tools simply because it is not recognized in IFRS. The regulator in Ontario has its own accounting standards that, for the most part, mirror the published accepted standard in Canada, that it will make deviations to accommodate assets and liabilities that are created from a regulatory smoothing or proceeding. The regulator looks to smooth rates. It looks to minimize intergenerational inequity in rate setting. It looks at cost allocation and rate design, and it tries to attribute causality to the costs that are being incurred by the system. This can create the assets and regulatory assets that absolutely diverge from the published financial statements. It's costly to maintain multiple sets of books, and the regulator is constantly grappling with the need to minimize these systemic costs, but its inability to do so. From a securities market perspective, a fundamental proponent or position of securities markets for over 100 years has been the notion of the full, true, and plain disclosure of all material fact. If there is no nexus between the financial statements, it's pretty difficult to see how disclosure from a utility or rate-regulated entity would be maintaining or meeting the statutory standard required by the securities regulator. And it is a primary tool that we have in Ontario to ensure that the purposes of the Securities Act are achieved. And that specifically requires the timely, accurate, and efficient disclosure of information. And we have gobs of disclosure and rulemaking that specifically delineate the types of disclosure and the manner of that disclosure. So if there is no nexus and investors must rely on other non-standard measures, then from all three of these perspectives, then the financial statements are not meeting the purpose for which they are intended. So I just wanted to add those points. Thank you.
Thank you. Mary?
I was noting that we've spent a lot of time focused on examples from both Europe and North America, in particular, you know, some discussion of South America, and I wondered if any of our participants from Asia, you know, Oceania, wanted to comment about whether experiences were similar in terms of both the nature of the regulation and how users of financial statements have they seen many IFRS compliant financial statements for regulated entities. Have you heard any comments or reactions? Is this discussion equally relevant, or are there different regional perspectives? I was curious about that.
Mary, I'm happy to give an Australian perspective.
Yeah. Okay, just as soon as Jacob, and then we'll let you come in, John. Thank you.
Mary, in South Africa, we also would like to apply regulatory assets liabilities. I think at this stage, our regulation environment is not as established as in some other countries. For example, in the past, in some cases, we had what we call clawbacks, basically where the regulator clawed back certain items or gave back certain items. In recent years, we have found that sometimes they don't do that. But there are established rules, but I think what's important to be able to take into account your regulatory assets liabilities is that the regulator must enforce the rules. So I think in South Africa, especially with energy, we have not seen that. There are, but maybe some areas, for example, in petrol price, etc., where it is applied. But I think if in South Africa, if we want to implement regulatory assets liabilities, we definitely need to work on the relationship with the regulator.
That's very helpful. John, do you
want to come in? Yeah, look, my perspective is probably the accounting preparation and also as an auditor. I think the same levels of frustration around the inability to recognise regulatory assets and liabilities certainly exist, and to those clients of mine and other contacts, I mean, that is certainly the common theme. On the how do you still achieve the level of disclosure to shareholders and users of those accounts? Having heard what others have said around the table around other disclosures and particularly around the segment note, I think that is true, and I think the segment note is now becoming less reconcilable back to the balance sheet and the income statement, because it usually reflects what the internal accounting is, and I heard earlier that is often quite different to what is presented in the accounts. The tension, I think, that exists certainly in the Australian environment is that the securities regulator here has taken a pretty hard line on giving prominence to non-IFRS reporting. So the whole concept of underlying profit or providing other disclosures that are non-IFRS, certainly in the last 18 months to 24 months, we've seen a lot of companies being challenged on that. And I think it's probably, if anything, it's causing tension in how do you still provide meaningful information if the IFRS accounted accounts, if the IFRS presented accounts for rate regulated entities doesn't allow you to provide that level of prominence to say that in fact there is volatility in the earnings because there is a deferral, if you like, of the ability to recover those costs.
Thank you. Kim, do you have anything to add about your jurisdiction?
Kyrgyz Caucasus import LNG and distribute it to consumers across the nation. Caucasus is owned by the 50% by the Korean government at public price. Actually, we have our the regulator has their guidelines for the public utilities, especially for raw material cost, indexation, and the supply cost. And the standard state that the charges shall be determined to cover all the actual incurred cost of the natural gas occurring due to import and supply activity performed by CoGas. Wholesale natural gas rate are calculated based on the budget amount and estimate of year And among the variation between the actual incurred cost and the first rate, the difference from oil price fluctuation are covered every 2 months. Others are adjusted at the end of year, at the end of year, and then charged in year N plus one. Over under recovery of year N is calculated according to guidelines above. So it is filed to government after reviewing by an accounting firm, and the year N plus one rate is approved by the government. So in some cases it happens the rate of year N plus one do not fully recover the incurred cost because government approved the parts of incurred costs of the or the supply quality of year N. If over under recovery of year N is not fully recovered in year N plus one, remaining amount will be included in adjustment over year N plus two again. This process continues until all actual incurred costs of year N are fully collected. So, in previous gap, recognized account receivable in our company, and but we adopt IFRS about 2 years ago, so we this is a very sensitive issue in our nation, so we need to recognize different accounts on the IFRS scheme.
Thank you. Manma?
Yeah, actually, we share some of the views of the other regions. In fact, in addition to, we are adopting IFRS, in fact. We are in compliance with our IFRS. We have included in our accounts also and some disclosure regarding our regulation. And for example, we have the scheme of control. Our regulation is in terms of the scheme of control, and we included in our financial statements some notes to explain some kind of a regulatory aspects, in fact. And we have also included in our financial statements some kind of supplementary information in terms of the profit and loss calculated in accordance with the scheme of control. The schemes and regulations. In fact, we have both regulated assets and regulated liabilities. Actually, in the past, we have more of the regulated liabilities than our regulated assets. But in terms of the coming years, we see that there is a trend of more and more regulated assets than the liability. And our experience with our auditors is that it's more difficult to substantiate regulated assets and liabilities. So, so we are okay in our financial statements to regulate to present and to recognize both regulated assets and liabilities because our regulated liabilities is more than the regulated assets. But but in accordance with the IFRS, it's more difficult if the regulated asset is more than the regular liabilities, then we need to wash out some of the asset in the statements. So that's why I think in the future, if there's no deferred accounts or things like that, we have to disclose more in our commentary or shared experience of the others that we need to have a separate set or accounts in our financial statements in order to what we think is more accurately reflect our underlying economics.
Thank you. Lily?
Yes. In Israel, the government companies authority performs the role of the ownership function. So we have three rate regulators for the three different entities that perform the utilities fields, but we have only one regulator which functions as the ownership and function, and we see all the all the financial statements of each one of the three entities. So our role is to advise the ministers, the royal ministers, the line ministers of the entities which are which are regulated. And because the three of them are different and under different accounting standards and methods, then we ask them to put in their notes a lot of information which helps us to compare the comparability between the three of them. So I'll give you some examples for the notes. Which of the regulatory different account balance rely on formal decisions of the regulatory rate, and which of the management's estimates that do not rely on such decisions? For assessments that do not rely on, as mentioned above, we ask a detailed explanation. The second is whether there are disagreements with the regulator upon the different accounts balances. Where there are disagreements, we ask detailed explanation and disclosure in the notes to the financial statement, including the implications of such disagreements on the company's financial position and results. The third is the changes in regulatory different accounts, including amounts added this year or reduced this year, and interest accumulated in respect of these amounts. The four is detailed regulatory different accounts of long and short term and current maturities of long term accounts and disclosure regarding to the expected recovery periods detailed by years. The fifth is information regarding expenses or income related to the changes in regulatory deferred accounts. And the sixth is information regarding to the main principles of the rate setting mechanism, which is very important to us to compare the regulators, the rate regulators. And the last one is accounting policy, describing the accounting principles on which the treatment of the regulatory deferred accounts balance is based. Each one of them is different. One adopted fully IFRS, the second is the subject to Israeli GAAP, and uses the RE6 for the difference. And the third one, which is under the securities law, is adopted IFRS with exception of the RE6. So we have to compare, and the ministers have to make decisions according with these different statements. Casey.
Several months ago, we hosted a roundtable of about a half a dozen investor analysts to get feedback from them on what they wanted in financial statements, not on this issue, but more broadly. And one of the complaints that they had was, in particular, the power, utility, water, gas industries were fairly dispersed. In fact, there are over 100 investor-owned utilities, water, gas, electric in the U.S., and this group of analysts has to cover all of them. And the volume of work that that drives is very difficult, and they asked for greater transparency in the financial statements and the footnotes and other disclosures about the timing of cash flows and the impact of regulation. So, you know, as I listened to Tim and Sherman and Karen, everyone seemed to talk about the pro forma impact that they put into the GAAP financial statements because of regulation. If you multiply that times dozens or 20s and 30s and 40s of companies that you're covering, it becomes too difficult a task for these guys to go unpack and get all that information to get to the adjusted earnings numbers they're looking for. So I think when we think of usability of financial statements, if in fact they consider the timing impacts of regulatory cash flows in their investment decisions, divorcing them from the financial statements means a lot of work for them to reconcile back to those GAAP financials. And again, you multiply that times the dispersed industry. Oil and gas, there might be 5 companies to cover. Electricity, there might be 50 companies to cover. And it becomes very time consuming and prone to error.
Okay, thank you. Brian, did you want to add anything as a regulator?
I'll just make some brief comments, since everybody said pretty much what I was going to touch upon. But I just want to emphasize that once a regulator established that a regulatory asset exists, those amounts are basically guaranteed for recovery. Mm-hmm. And what we have done in the United States for those that have not had that specific order, even if it was based on past decisions, we kind of ramped up our auditing function to ensure that those decisions will flow through. And if not, we will make them companies write them off of the balance sheet. But the commission, in terms of in use of general purpose financial statements, I think Karen touched upon it. We have our own financial statement that they filed with the FERC called Form 1. But that heavily overlaps with the general purpose financial statement of the rate-regulated entities that's subject to FAS 71. And we use both in determining how we set rates. We use both. Some companies sometimes ask for a waiver to pay dividends out of capital accounts. We want to look at all the financial statements to make sure that they can do that. We use them in the cost of service rate making, whether it's a fixed rate proceeding where the rate does not change to the next rate case, or whether it's a formula rate proceeding where the rate changes constantly based on the account that makes up that rate. We're also responsible for debt issuances, well, on a short-term basis and long-term basis of certain utilities. In that, we analyze the interest coverage ratio, and we also look at the utility ability to pay back the debt. So we have some of the common things that I've heard around here. It certainly applies to the regulator. We just established an energy policy group. We look at both forms to establish future policy for the commission as it affects rates. We also have a pretty aggressive division of investigations, and when we levy a civil penalty, sometimes we get hardship cases. We have to be able to analyze those financial statements to see whether the company has the ability to pay that penalty, oftentimes in the millions. On some of the audits that I do, they are very critical. We look at both sides so I can properly determine scope, so I can properly determine risk. As a regulator, we get a bunch of accounting requests in from the rate-regulated entities. I have to ensure that once we approve those, that they're reflected in the financial statements. And as those financial statements diverge, it makes that job more, just that much more difficult. But one of the bigger areas that we look at is in our whole mergers. There's a lot of mega mergers that happens in the United States. And we look at that, so we look at the level of the merger cost. We look at the synergies. We look at how the company subsequent advance. And sometimes I can tell you, those notes, they are not always the same between what we collect as a regulator and what they were published in with the SEC. We also look at how companies share their taxes in a consolidated basis. These financial statements become critical, and the more they diverge, it makes the regulator job harder. Even though we are requesting that same information from the financial forms that comes into us. We also look at how they obtain their capital, how they infusion capital, how they pay in dividends, their ability to pay dividends. So what I heard around the table seems to be sort of consistent, but the regulator is just not looking at this just to set rates. They look at it to set the terms and conditions by which that rate is charged. It's a heavy use in our enforcement program, too. Thank you.
I'd like to just ask Casey to clarify his comments on the group of analysts he was speaking to and the conclusions that he was drawing from what they were saying. Were the analysts that you were speaking to following North American companies that follow U.S. GAAP, or were they following IFRS companies? Did they have deferral accounts? Were they looking at companies with deferral accounts and asking for additional information, even though they had the deferral accounts, or were they looking at statements without deferral accounts?
They were looking at U.S. GAAP statements that had regulatory asset deferral accounts. They seek better information about the timing of when those deferrals will reverse. When will those regulatory assets convert into cash? And as Karen talked about and Brian talked about, they often go into the regulatory filings to dig that information out, which is very doable. That information is available, but when you start having to do it for multiple companies and a great volume of companies getting that information,
definition is challenging, which was one of their suggestions to us, is better transparency in the U.S. GAAP financial statements with the deferrals about the reversal, the timing of the collection of those assets. I'm sort of extending that to, well, if you're not going to have those deferral accounts in your financials, but you still believe measuring those future cash flows is important, you're going to pro forma the actual results for those effects. And it's one more step of reconciliation that they'll have to go through, again, for multiple companies. You know, I just pulled up the press release for a British company that owns very significant U.S. utility investments, and there's 35 pages of discussion about U.S. regulatory, you know, the differences between cash flows on an IFRS basis and a U.S. regulatory basis. So they believe, you know, I'm inferring because of the length of the discussion, they believe that information is important for investors.
Thank you.
Just have a very quick question. Brian and some others also mentioned that the write-off of regulatory assets, are those write-off for the assets that have been approved or write-off for the assets that have not yet been approved? I just want to see the distinction.
These were ones that did not have a specific order from the regulator, but they were relying on that the regulator may have approved those costs in the past. And in this particular situation, the entity had multiple opportunities to come in and ask for that. So at that point, I felt as if you should write it off if you did not do that.
But when they approve, has there been any write-off?
No. I have not seen
that. It's a certainty, right? It's only the ones which are not approved.
From the ones that I've seen, once they have been approved, they allow to collect the revenue. I think some of the regulated entities go.
Yeah, Michelle, I think that's right. Approval may include a judicial review, so there could be an appeal of a regulatory order. But once that process is adjudicated, once it's done, it's done. And in the States, there's a long history of prohibitions against retroactive rate making. So a former regulator, their orders stand, and it can't be like politically somebody new comes in and just pretends it didn't exist.
Yeah, in Canada, we have the balance accounts, you know, for the pass-through, just to be short. For the pass-through accounts, the account number where you put those costs, the difference between the actual and what you have billed, it goes in an account which is pre-approved by the regulator. Says we approve the principle of the difference between the actual and the budget, but we'll look at it later on. But the issue is just like just to rubber stamp that you put the right numbers in it. So the pre-approved account is fine. It's the deferred account where you incur a cost and it was not pre-approved and it's not a system to approve it. It said, well, I'm going to put it on my balance sheet and I'm going to look at it. Well, am I going to get 100% back, 50%, maybe 50? Talk to the auditor, sergeant, well, I believe it should be 40. You finalize it, you put 45 on the balance sheet. This is the one at risk. It's not really the balance account, the pass-through account, or the accounts which have been approved by the regulator. So it's really decreased the number of accounts which are at risk when you look at your balance sheet in terms of the regulatory assets, right?
Well, yeah, under U.S. GAAP, at least, the recognition criteria takes into account likelihood.
Correct.
I've heard some talk about, well, should that be a measurement rather than recognition? I don't think that's discussion for today, but you're correct.
Jane? Okay. Thank you. That was exceptionally useful information. We have been struggling to get information about how the regulatory information that's in some jurisdictions has been used by regulators, by analysts, equity analysts, as well as credit agencies and banks, etc. So that was very, very helpful. And I think unless anybody has got anything to add, it's probably a good time to move on and at least have a session before lunch to introduce the papers for the rest of the session.
Yeah, I very interesting session on users. When we did the EFRAG first meeting, we also looked at what information management itself used. I wouldn't like to lose sight of that because users, of course, are critical, and then also how management uses information, I think, is related importance as well, particularly since the board has been moving down the through the eyes of management. It touches on IFRS 8. I have to disagree with Richard in some way on his views on IFRS 8, which I think is important, but I wouldn't want us to lose sight of that.
Thank you. Thanks, Bill.
Okay, if we move on.